Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning as we get into another week's worth of programming. We'll have here in this first hour of Focus 580 another opportunity for you to talk with a candidate here from the central part of Illinois. We try to do this in the run-up to elections to give voters the opportunity to candidates, reporters, get to do that all the time, and I have some questions that I will ask. But the important thing here is that if there are people who are listening who would like to talk with our guest, you're certainly welcome to do that. And the guest is Tim Johnson. He is a Republican member of Congress from Illinois' 15th district. He is the incumbent here in this district and is up for re-election once again. And we're glad to have him here. His opponent, by the way, David Gill, was on this program on September 11th. If you want to hear that show, if you didn't hear it, you can go and listen on the website. Also, I want to mention that the two of them will be appearing together on a program this coming Friday evening at 8 o'clock on our companion station, WILL-TV. Another opportunity to see both candidates and hear from both of them. Questions here on this program are welcome. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much.
David, I'm glad to be here.
I think for a lot of people, one of the most important issues, certainly international issues, remains the war in Iraq. Now it looks as if perhaps the Bush administration is starting to lay the groundwork for perhaps some change in direction. At the very least, James Baker, former Secretary of State, was on TV yesterday. He heads up an Iraq task force, and he said he thinks that it's time for a change and says that there may be something in between the administration's commitment to stay the course and others who say we just ought to pull out, something in between those two. What now? What do you think we should be doing about Iraq?
Well, the overwhelming sentiment of people, not only in this district, but I would contend around the country, Dave, is that we need to have a plan, which really doesn't exist now, to my knowledge, for the exit of American troops and the turnover, hopefully sooner rather than later, in toto of security and government to the Iraqis. We are now in 2006. We're not in 2003, and so we don't have the benefit of hindsight. We do hopefully have the benefit of good foresight, and it's my judgment that we need to, for the purposes of international relations and our ability to maintain or acquire, as you will, the confidence of the American people, have a plan for withdrawal of American troops. So I'm not a micromanager. I'm not in a position to be able to know precisely how that will be implemented, David, or otherwise. But I can tell you that there's tremendous distress on the part of a lot of people, including members of Congress, that a plan needs to exist, and perhaps that needs to be developed sooner rather than later.
Would you expect that there would be some kind of continued American presence now for the foreseeable future? And there, I guess I'm thinking of anywhere between another 5 and 10 years.
Well, I hope not. I'm hopeful that that will not be the case. Now, if you're talking about American presence, will we have advisors and true advisors, not the Vietnam era advisors, or individuals who are there to help the transition to democracy and transition to new government and security? Maybe. But if you're talking about a 5 or 10 year existence of American troops in large numbers, then my hope would be that that would not only be not necessary, but that would not happen.
It seems that there are a significant number of Americans now who think that it was a mistake to go into Iraq. Some of those people who initially had supported it, do you still believe that this was the right thing to do?
Well, again, I don't have the benefit of 2020 hindsight. Obviously, I believe a lot of people would have made very, very different decisions in 2003 had we known then what we know now. And I don't like to get in the speculation business. I will simply summarize my position as saying that there are some very different factors now that exist and probably existed then than we thought, and I think we would have made some very different decisions had we known those conditions existed.
Well, do you think, I know that there are some people who think that the administration misled the American people. Do you think that the administration gave the Congress the information that you all needed to make a good decision about whether or not this was the right thing to do?
I don't want to accuse the administration of misleading the Congress. I think that's a bit extreme and not something that I really feel that I'm prepared to say. I will say, however, that information that we had offered in good faith was less than entirely helpful and indicated in a particular way. And so I'm very concerned about where we were, but more particularly I'm concerned about where we are right now. And I'm concerned about what role the Congress plays. On the one hand, we don't have a chance to go back and revisit votes, and I'm not going to speculate about that. We do have the appropriations process, and obviously no one's going to suggest we should leave men and women there without body armor. And at the same time, we have the power of suasion. And I think a good many people, including people who are Republican members of Congress, are going to suggest, as we have, to the administration in various ways, that we need to have a plan, and we need to have light at the end of the tunnel, and that the tunnel be relatively short.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have several callers here ready to go.
Now, the callers, I will add, are not ours. I know there's always been an election tradition that we've not followed to get people to call. So any of these calls are going to be spontaneous in the good keeping of WILL's system of neutral reporting.
All right. We'll start here with, I guess we'll just go right to line number one. Right here. Hello.
Good morning. Let me turn my phone up, sir, so please don't hang up. Hello?
Okay, yeah, I can hear you just fine.
Huh? Yes?
I can hear better now.
Okay.
I'd like to go to domestic policy issues, and I'd like to talk about the internet neutrality, which is a great concern for people in our area. We have a lot of computer users, a lot of bloggers. The internet is just a really essential part of life in District 15. I understand,
as it is in every district, I would say, or probably around the country.
I understand that the issue of internet neutrality is based on a couple of facts, that right now these phone lines, the internet lines, are currently owned by AT&T, and that right now they cannot just set rates at will. And it is my understanding that the new federal communications bill regarding the internet has simply said that AT&T can set any rates for anybody any way they want to. And I know enough, every time I hear the word reform, that it's going to cost me more money. And I know that you voted for the new communications bill, which would allow AT&T to charge whatever rates they want to whatever individuals. And some people I've heard say, oh, well, you know, this is a way to control the pornographers. Well, the pornographers have so much money that they can pay, you know, any bill that AT&T might give them for carrying their information. I'm sure AT&T doesn't know what they might be carrying. But the average person who wants to be able to have instant communication, which they have now at a reasonable rate, will suddenly find themselves paying enormous charges. And I've heard, you know, the expression, well, we're just selling the internet to AT&T and Verizon, and they will at their own discretion decide who they will charge for what to transmit what is now being transmitted at a very low rate for everybody. And you voted for that bill. Now, I hope I have my facts right. And if I don't, please help me out.
Well, let me just say that the net neutrality, which, by the way, is being debated in the Senate now, and there's certainly a strong likelihood or some possibility that in the conference report that issue will be more specifically addressed. Keep in mind that this was a massive telecom rewrite bill. The bill passed, and the provisions that you've made reference to are only a very, very small part of the bill.
It's a very important part.
Well, let me ask this. Do you want a response, or do you just want, if you want to just talk, I'll be glad to listen to you. And if you don't, you go ahead. No, I don't want to interrupt you. You just go ahead and talk and say whatever you'd like to say.
No, because I would like to hear your response.
Well, it's sort of hard to respond if you talk over me. So go ahead and talk, and I'll wait till you're done.
No, I want you to address my questions.
Okay. Well, ma'am, let's go ahead. Go ahead. Okay.
The net neutrality aspects of the bill were very, very one part, but a very small part of the bill. The bill passed by an overwhelming margin, both Republicans and Democrats. In fact, Bobby Rush from Chicago was one of the.
And it's disgusting. He certainly has been. Bought.
Ma'am, please.
No, that's okay. You just go ahead, because I'm honestly not going to try to respond when you interrupt everything I say.
Go ahead. I will be very good, and I will listen if you will address the internet neutrality part of the bill. That's my biggest concern. Whether it is a small part of the bill or not, it has a huge effect on people.
Well, and maybe we should give Tim a chance to do that. So, Tim,
right.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Tim, go ahead.
Let me just say that it was certainly a significant but a relatively smaller part of a massive bill that passed by an overwhelming margin, liberals, Republicans, Democrats, Republicans joining in support of the bill, with the fundamental concept being to create competition in the area to lower prices. The bill is now, as I said, in the Senate. Net neutrality, as well as a number of other provisions, are in the process of being debated, not as we speak, but shortly after we return after the election. And I believe that there'd be sufficient safeguards in place and otherwise to assure not only continued free access, but also greatly reduced rates because of the competition that's guaranteed within the bill. You certainly have a right to disagree, and I understand that, and I'd certainly be glad to look as we go through the conference report. But I think it would be incorrect to describe this bill as being a net neutrality bill when huge, huge portions of the bill are designed to address the overall issue of lower costs, lower rates in the cable industry.
Now, I want to give the caller a chance to follow up quickly, but please, I'd have other callers. I want to give them a chance, too. So you want to go ahead?
I just want to say that every time they have a bill to give us more competition for cable network, the prices always go up. However, my concern is not about cable. My concern is about net neutrality. And you, sir, voted against network neutrality. Now, you can tell me all you want that there's going to be a conference committee. I would like to point out that the conference committee is only and has always only been made up of Republicans in this administration. The Democrats.
No. Let me just correct that. That is absolutely incorrect. That is flatly untrue. That a conference committee is always, in every case, including this bill, made up of members of both the Republican and the Democratic caucuses from both the Senate and the House.
So you are. That's not been my experience. Let me
correct that. You are 100% incorrect. A conference committee in every case is both Republicans and Democrats, both senators and House members. I don't know what you say your experience has been. If you can tell me one situation where there's ever been a conference committee in the history of the United States Congress that hasn't had both members of the party, both political parties on it, then you know something that I don't. That's simply not correct.
I'm not going to debate that because that is a side issue, and I let your position stand. But I am concerned that you voted against network neutrality. And when you talk about competition in the cable industry, you are not mentioning that this bill gives AT&T and Verizon total control over how they want to set rates for the internet, and you voted for it. You can tell me that there were some Democrats who voted for it. You can tell me that Bobby Rush, who used to be very liberal and has now been bought out by whoever does the buying, you, sir, voted against network neutrality, and I'm asking how you personally can justify letting AT&T and Verizon set the prices. Now, it was done very, very quietly. This bill was not talked about publicly, and it was only as people began to listen to the concerns of Democratic bloggers on the internet that suddenly this became an issue. But I'd like to know how you personally can justify your vote to sell the network, the ability to set prices to Verizon and AT&T. I'm asking you to justify your vote against network neutrality.
Well, that's not correct, and the net neutrality is a misnomer, David, that is oftentimes used to elicit emotions on this issue, which is unfortunately not correct. The FCC has been designated and will be designated to monitor any potential abuses in this area. My belief is, and the belief of people on both sides of the aisle in overwhelming numbers, that there will be fine mechanisms in place to assure that the current free access to the Internet at the rates now available will continue on. As a matter of fact, I think you'll probably see a decrease in rates as we go along across the board. And anytime you enhance competition, then that produces the appropriate results. And so with all due respect to the caller, who obviously feels very strongly about it, and I respect that, her perception of the bill and the process is simply not correct.
Well, I hope the caller will forgive me. I simply have to move on. We have some other callers. Our guest this morning is Tim Johnson. He's a member of Congress, a Republican, representing the 15th Congressional District, also a candidate here standing for re-election. He was first elected to Congress in 2000. Before that, served for more than two decades in the Illinois House, and before that was a member of the Urbana City Council. Questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next up is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Representative Johnson. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. My name's Matthew Murray, and I'm calling with questions about universal health coverage, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the thing first I want to do is often I hear people just talking about, you know, theory, et cetera. And, you know, I work for the school district, and we do have group coverage. And the payment that we make out of our family for family coverage is $698 per month. That comes to about a little over $8,300 a year. And the total premiums, the school kicks in money, so the total premiums come to about $12,876, and you know, to me, it's the coverage is mediocre to fair, is how I describe it, because we still have to pay, you know, office copays, and it's a 2080 plan, and I really just, you know, whenever people ask, there, you know, sometimes people, I talk to my mom, she's kind of shocked, because you know, in her generation, that just would have been astronomical, and I always just tell people, you know, I wouldn't mind if I were paying that money to the federal government in taxes, and it was providing, you know, coverage for everyone. And I really don't understand. I haven't heard an argument yet against universal health coverage that makes any sense anymore. And I wonder what your take is on that.
Sure.
And I'll listen for a little bit.
Yeah, if you're talking about universal health care as a specific bill, mm-hmm. as opposed to universal health care that we all seek to obtain for American citizens, obviously that's a different issue. My belief is that the best way that we can assure, and I'd be the first to say that we don't have a system that's by any means perfect as we sit here today, to assure better health care, not only better health care, but more particularly more access to health care, is through a series of legislation, both at a federal and state level, that will assure that. Association health plans, health savings accounts, coverage of pre-existing conditions, our low-income coverage and CHIPS programs and things of that sort, both at the federal and state level, that provide or would provide greater access to health care without what is, I believe, widely considered to be, anyway, some of the potential problems that are existing in a quote-unquote universal health care. Even the head of the Canadian Medical Society, and Canada obviously has a system that runs on the quote-unquote universal health care model, would suggest to you that it isn't working well, that the access, that the quality of health care, that the wait time is dramatically increased, the quality dramatically reduced, and that a huge portion of the budget of provinces in Canada and the country becomes increasingly devoted to that piece of legislation, which many, many people feel, consumers and otherwise, isn't working well. And so as panacea-like as it may seem in some areas, I would suggest that we can reach the same objective through a variety of appropriate, targeted, and less costly, and more quality-producing approaches through the private sector and otherwise.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because actually I think that's similar to actually what the Hillary Clinton plan was, which was to essentially try to get coverage through the profitable, you know, through the market. And I just don't see it. I mean, you know, when I first started arguing with people or trying to convince people about universal health coverage, that was maybe like 15 or 20 years ago, and people would say, oh, but you'll lose your choices. You'll lose your choices. And, I have no choices, really. I mean, I have a choice of two plans, and both are very restrictive. And, you know, when I looked at the money we spend 16% of our family income on health insurance only, not even on health. That doesn't include payments, co-payments, deductibles, et cetera. And, I look at the problem, and I see, like, I'm looking right here at the Weiss Ratings, you know, which is the investment firm, and they see HMO profits jump 21% in the first quarter of 2005, and those profits have not. I mean, they far outstrip cost of living adjustments, and I just don't see what the reason not to back. Like, when I look at, like, I think it's Conyers has a House Resolution 676 in Congress, in the House of Representatives, for universal health coverage. It just seems to make so much more sense. And, you know, I think people will complain sometimes because I think the cost will, you know, it will even it out more so that, like, you know, it would probably be 10% of people's, you know, income would be taxed. But as it's going, to me, the trend is going such that through the marketplace, it's getting worse. It's not getting better. And I don't see where spreading it around and handing it over to the private sector is making it better. And I would just encourage you to really think about if, you know, jumping on board universal health coverage, because I think it's better. And it really sickens me that you know, 45, 46 million people don't have any health insurance. And that seems so wrong and so unfair to me. I mean, I just don't understand that in this country with our resources to allow that seems really wrong. So.
Well, sure. And the caller very articulately posits the case for H.R. 676. And with all due respect, I simply don't believe, and I think the wide consensus among members of the Congress and, quite frankly, around the world, is that the model doesn't work well. If they're paying 16% of your income now in health care, it's going to go up dramatically through the government-run system that's rampant in countries where this is existent. And it's no accident that people, David, all over the world come to the United States for health care, serious health care issues, because the quality of care is so poor in those countries. It's also no accident that because of the overuse of the system, people have dramatic waits for the simplest of surgeries, the referrals from general practitioners to specialists. And the quality of health care, the access of health care, and the cost are so high or low, according to one of those nouns that you look at, that it simply doesn't work in the manner that we'd all like to see it work. Now, would I like to assure, through association health plans, through health savings accounts, and otherwise, as well as targeted pieces of legislation to address the uninsurable, everyone in the United States to be covered by health insurance? Yes. There's certainly a number of areas that we can approach that will reduce that number of uninsured. We're never going to reduce it completely, I would suggest. And for those who fall beyond that insurance safety net, we have and we need to bolster, and that's part of the reason I voted against budget reconciliation, because I didn't think that it was appropriately framed. A system, both at a federal and state level, who provide health care access, insurance or otherwise, to people who don't have that access now. And so I think we're both about the same objective. It's just that we may have a little different method of getting there.
We are already at the midpoint here. Our guest is Congressman Tim Johnson. We're certainly open to questions from people who are listening, and the lines are full now, and people will help us if they can try to be brief with their questions. 333-9455.
I can help you if I make my response is brief.
Well,
too,
I think
right
it's here. Probably but I think it's probably more important if the callers will help us by being brief too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next is Champagne, and this is line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I have two quick questions, but I'll let you answer them.
Okay.
The first one is, why in the world do you want to run for Congress again when it's been shown that Congress is totally irrelevant with all of the signing statements?
With all the what?
The presidential signing statements that just gut whatever legislation or rules that you pass anyway?
Well, I'm not sure I understand what you're why you think Congress is irrelevant.
Because the president can do a signing statement that can undo whatever bills or parts of bills or whatever that the Congress passes, and there was absolutely no outrage against this from Congress that I heard.
Yeah, I didn't understand what you said. Yeah, well, I guess I would would hope that we're not irrelevant, and I don't believe that. And certainly, are there areas when you'd like to be able to buttress the role of Congress and diminish the role of the executive branch to the appropriate balance? Absolutely, but I don't think that indicates that we're irrelevant. And certainly, we're not irrelevant when it comes to passing policy issues in the form of various kinds of legislation that go to the president. So I understand your point, and part of our obligation, obviously, as elected representatives of the people, is to assure that we're not irrelevant. And I would also suggest to you that, and I think you know this, that in addition to our legislative role, we also have a role that consumes a huge portion of our time and our staff's time. And that is just providing simple services to people, being able to access the VA disability system, to be able to access Social Security disability, to be able to assure that the bureaucracy that faces them is something that's not so overwhelming that they can't deal with it, to deal with infrastructure needs for small towns and rural areas as well as for the University of Illinois and otherwise. So my hope is that we're not irrelevant, and I guess if I feel like I'm irrelevant, then maybe I'll change my mind. But at this point, I don't think that I am.
My other question is a quick one, too. Last week, or at the end of September, I was absolutely mortified and embarrassed for our country that our Congress was debating things like torture, habeas corpus, representing or allowing people who were imprisoned. We don't know if people were innocent or guilty, but they're not allowed to have legal representation. They're not allowed to have question their detention. They're not allowed to see the evidence against them. All of these things that were in several bills that were put through Congress the end of September, and from what I understand from reading in the paper, you voted for both of those major bills, one including the Military Commissions Act. I don't know what the other one was. Specifically,
you're talking about the Electronic Surveillance Act?
Right, the Electronic Surveillance Act and those sorts of things. How you in Congress can give away our Constitution. And in fact, I've heard a couple of constitutional lawyers and international legal experts contend that by the very voting for the bill, you may have committed a War Crimes Act, or at least a Crimes Against Humanity Act. And how do you feel about being possibly apprehended for being a part of?
Well, they know my address. I suppose the federal marshals will come and pick me up tomorrow, if that's the case.
But you feel okay about voting for?
No, because I didn't vote for it. I didn't vote for the National Security Agency Surveillance Act. I didn't vote for the Patriot Act. I voted against both those, so I don't know where you got your information.
Well, did you vote for this one that had to do with the Military Commissions Act?
The interrogations bill?
Yes,
I did. As a matter of fact, the bill as it originally came out of the administration, I opposed. I did not support the proposals of the administration. As you're probably aware, Senator McCain, Senator Lindsey Graham, Senator John Warner, sat down with Senator Frist and others, and Democrats as well, and hammered out, and those are strong civil libertarians, Lindsey Graham and otherwise, what most people felt was a very strong compromise to eliminate a lot of those abuses that you make reference to. It was only then, after the compromise that was reached, that I did vote in favor of the Interrogations Act, and I believe that it's appropriately worded now.
No.
I don't know where you got your information. I voted for the electronic surveillance legislation because I didn't.
Okay, I apologize.
That's okay.
For misreading that.
That's okay. I'm not too concerned about being arrested for my vote, but hopefully those are both areas.
So it doesn't bother you that you could possibly be pointed out 10 years from now as a possible contributing to war crimes?
Well, I certainly don't want to be accused of contributing to war crimes, no.
Let me just real quick go back to the question of presidential power, because this administration has been accused of trying to increase and enhance the power of the executive at the expense of the legislative. That's what the whole issue about the signing statement is all
correct,
about.
Yeah.
So you don't feel that this administration has done, or do you feel that this administration has done anything to upset the balance of power?
Yes, I do. Oh, absolutely.
Congress?
I think the caller is correct. Absolutely. And I simply said I didn't feel irrelevant in the process, but I think the caller is absolutely right. And there's tremendous potential in this administration and otherwise for an imbalance between the three branches of government. And I believe that in a good many cases, in fact, the last caller, when she's talking about electronic surveillance, interrogations and otherwise, that the administration has gone too far in terms of its quote-unquote authority. And I think the Congress needs to assert itself. And if you give me time to respond, my record on separation of powers, my record on civil liberties is one that's very, very strong. I practiced criminal law and defense capacity for many, many, many years, and so I'm aware of abuses through the executive branch and otherwise. And so I am concerned, David, about imbalance of power, and I want to do everything that I can as a member of Congress to assure that that balance is restored and that protections are afforded through the Congress that are upheld through the process. And so, yes, the answer is yes, I am concerned about abuses of executive power, and that's quite frankly the reason I voted a number of cases that I have against the Patriot Act, against its reauthorization, against the Surveillance Act, and in favor of a number of other specific areas that I think address that area or that issue. And so it causes me great concern.
All right. We have some other callers here. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Tim Johnson. He's Republican member of Congress. He represents Illinois' 15th district in the House. Was first elected to Congress in 2000. Before that, served in the Illinois House. Also served on the Urbana City Council. And he's one of a number of candidates we've invited here on the program in the run-up to the election to give folks the chance to talk. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So those are the numbers. And we have several callers. So again, we'll try to get as many as we can.
Let me just say, David, and I realize some of these, the call is very, very good, very informative and very helpful. But I think one of the realities is, or one of the problems is, when you're a member of a particular political party, then when you're on a talk show, you're viewed as a target, a potential target for all the concerns and complaints that they may have about the national leadership of your party. I've carved out a very strong independent voting record. In fact, one of the most independent voting records in the entire United States Congress. Very moderate, very balanced, and I take a lot of pride in that. And so I'm not going to be perhaps as convenient a target for some of these criticisms of what people perceive as inappropriate actions on the part of the administration than maybe a typical member would be. I value my independence. I'm not embarrassed at all to be a Republican. But at the same time, when I think the administration or the leadership of our party is wrong, then I act accordingly.
Well, if we have to use one of the conventional labels to describe where you are, would you feel comfortable with being described as a conservative?
I consider myself a moderate to conservative, yes. I don't like labels, and so I don't know that I don't know that I would put a particular label on myself. But I would suppose, depending on the issue, that I would be viewed as either a moderate or conservative or somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go on and talk with some other folks. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I'm gratified by your position on a speedy withdrawal from Iraq. However, at the present time, when I think a majority of the American people see the policy in Iraq as something of a failure, it appears the administration is now considering military action against Iran, and I point to their moving a fleet to the Persian Gulf. My question is, would you oppose military action against Iran at this time?
At this time, and of course we haven't discussed this morning North Korea, and obviously the overnight revelations about the testing of successful testing of nuclear weaponry in North Korea. But at this point, I think that military action anywhere, North Korea or Iran, would be tremendously premature. And I think maybe buying ourselves into a problem that in hindsight we might have avoided or managed to look at in a more judicious way 3 years ago. So at this point, I would not, if you asked me to vote for authorization of force, knowing more, no more than I know now with respect to both Iran and North Korea, I would not support that. Now, are there facts or matters that come to my attention that would cause me to relook at that? Of course. But at this point, I think we need to look at the international community, to sanctions where that's appropriate, and to a diplomatic solution to issues rather than the exercise of military force.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Does the commitment of troops in Iraq, particularly here I'm thinking of National Guard, does that concern you at all when it comes to the Guard being able to do what is their more traditional kind of activities, particularly dealing with natural disaster, those sorts of things at home? Are concerned.
Oh, sure. There's always a limited, finite number of ways that individuals can be used. In fact, a member of our office, our chief of staff, is a member of the Guard, and we need to make sure that those are appropriately balanced. On the other hand, I don't think we can make the unilateral decision that Guard troops can never be used in foreign affairs, because there's certainly a number of cases where that's appropriate and necessary.
All right, let's go to Danville, line 4. Hello.
Yes, Tim. What about concealed carry in Illinois and tort reform for health care? Thank you.
Well, I'm in favor of, as a state legislator, concealed carry in Illinois, but I'm not a member of the Illinois legislature. So what I would suggest that you do is to elect the right person, maybe a Vermillion County person, for example, to the Illinois Senate, and assure that we have an opportunity to have that enacted into law in Illinois. I'm a very strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I forgot what the second question was.
Tort reform.
Oh, I don't know. What do you mean about that?
From malpractice situations?
Would it help lower the cost, like that other gentleman was referring to, without going to universal? Would tort reform, limiting liability and so on, help lower the cost?
Well, some people have suggested it would, and I guess we'll have a chance to find out, because the Illinois legislature enacted and the governor signed, I think last spring or the previous spring, a tort reform, quote-unquote, caps at a state level, and I think we'll have a chance to see how that does or doesn't work. I think that's a decision, just like the Second Amendment, that is best left, at least in that arena, to the state government rather than the federal government. So, I think I'll have to rely on the good wisdom of the Illinois Senate and House and the governor make appropriate solutions.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Champaign County next. Line 2, hello.
Hi. The Military Commission Act that was referred to earlier that you thought was a compromise, it was actually argued over in Vice President Cheney's office, and it's widely regarded as a complete capitulation to what the Bush administration wanted. So as far as it being some compromise, that's not what the way it's a lot of people see it. And
well, maybe you read different accounts than I do.
Well, the New York Times and the Washington Post, which I guess you can call the liberal media, not the Washington Post, has been very liberal, had very scathing reviews of the military commission, so-called compromise.
Let me just suggest that I would hardly think that people who look to Senator McCain, to Senator Graham, to Senator Warner as individuals who are involved in capitulation. Senator McCain has long been a proponent, as Senator Graham is. He's actually a military judge. Long been regarded as strong proponents of human rights, of addressing the issue of torture and otherwise. And I tend over time to rely on the reputations and the credibility and the integrity of individuals like that. And perhaps read different accounts than you did, but the accounts I read were very, very supportive of what people felt was a reasonable compromise with individuals who had strong feelings about the issue.
Well, betraying nearly 1,000 years of Western civilization history with getting rid of habeas corpus, I don't think is a reasonable compromise. And it was used by the British during wartime. If you were a Frenchman caught behind the lines, even during the 30 Years' War, you could actually invoke habeas corpus. So this business about it's a war and everything is different doesn't come from the English common law on that. I actually wanted to ask you about more medical questions. it seems that three-quarters of the counties in your district are regarded as medically underserved by the state. I wonder if there's anything that you've done substantively or otherwise to respond to the... I'm getting my figures from the Illinois State Rural Health website, which I was just looking at this morning. It doesn't include Piatt County in the references, so I don't know whether they're medically underserved or not.
What county is it?
Piatt County it doesn't show up in their records for some reason, so I don't understand. But
Piatt County is in good shape because we were in Monticello the other day, so it's right there. Man.
Well, no, but I mean, as far as being assessed to being medically underserved, I don't know. Maybe it's in good shape because your opponent is a good doctor over there. But
well, he's not in Piatt County, actually. You got the wrong county, but that's okay.
Clinton isn't in Piatt County.
No, it isn't.
Okay.
No, you better check your geography.
Well, anyway, I don't want to waste time on that. I'd like to know if you've done anything, co-sponsored any bills that have anything to do with improving rural health in your district.
Oh, absolutely. The Medicare Reform Act that we passed several years ago has expansive provisions in the bill with respect to, in fact, quite frankly, a good part of the reason why I supported the bill, to provide millions and millions of dollars for medically underserved areas, for rural health care providers, for rural hospitals. In fact, we've worked very aggressively with hospitals all around the all around the district, Robinson, in Watsika, in Gibson City, and otherwise, to be able to assure that the money goes there. And so that was a very, very important bill with respect to health care. We also have worked on an everyday basis with individual grants in those areas that are medically underserved and otherwise. Smaller rural health care providers are oftentimes in need of special assistance from the federal and state government. And we have been very, very successful and have gotten actually a number of recognitions in that regard as being able to provide those that assistance for those rural health care providers. Now, you combine that with, as the previous caller said, the area of civil justice and some of the specific pieces of legislation that are either being considered or have been successfully considered, my hope is that we can help address those needs in rural areas, because I would absolutely agree with you. We've got counties all over this district who have a small number of providers. Hoopston has a hospital that still exists. Unfortunately, there's a couple prior to my tenure in Congress that went out of business, so to speak. And so we work on a virtually everyday basis with assuring that we have greater access to health care in those smaller and rural areas. And do we have a perfect solution? No. But we've made a lot of improvements, and I think we're getting there.
We've got about 5 minutes left. I want to try and get at least one more. We'll go to Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'd like to applaud Mr. Johnson for his vote on the environment.
Well, thank you.
My question is this. There's a ruling that was passed back in the 80s during the Reagan administration when taxation was changed. And it's sometimes called the Windfall Profits Act or something.
I know
like
what you're
that.
Talking about. Yeah, right.
And it affects a lot of people in this area.
Absolutely.
Thousands of
sure.
people.
It's a huge issue. That's one of the biggest issues.
State of Illinois.
Right. Can I just kind of preempt you by explaining what it is and what we're trying to do about it?
Sure. You know more than I do about it.
Well, maybe. In 1977 and then in 1983, which demonstrates, I guess, that bad government is bipartisan, at least in this area, the Congress passed, the president signed, legislation that in effect penalizes people who are receiving state pensions in terms of their Social Security receipts, as well as their survivors. I am the sponsor of legislation to remove that inequity and to basically repeal what was done in 1977 and 1983 and allow people to have the benefit of their actual work so that they're able to receive full Social Security benefits when they work in that system, as well as full benefits to work in the SERS system or otherwise. That's a tremendous inequity and very, very unfair, and I'm in the process of addressing that. Thanks for mentioning the environment. I'm, I think, one of the few Republicans in the country that was endorsed by the Sierra Club, and large numbers of the environmental organizations throughout the district to recognize what I think is a strong commitment on my part to a better, cleaner environment, and I'm very proud of that. So you're nice to mention it.
Well, so where is the action now on this?
Windfall?
Mm-hmm.
It's,
yes.
It's still in the House. We have not passed it in the House yet. We're in the process of of working on the legislation almost as we speak. And again, I would like to tell you that we're going to pass it when we go back in November. But again, I'm one person out of 435, and Illinois is one of only a small number of states that's impacted directly. And so we have to persuade our colleagues of the unfairness of the current law.
The last time I read, we're one of 16 states that have this.
Yeah, and it is just not fair.
Exactly.
That an individual can work for many, many years for the state of Illinois, University of Illinois, teacher, whatever it may be, and then because they've been wise enough also to have acquired benefits in the Social Security system to have their wisdom penalized by the federal government. So you are absolutely right, ma'am, and we've been working on that for some time, and hopefully we'll enjoy some success in the legislative process.
Now, I'm curious, where does that money go that's withheld?
Not withheld. It's just never paid out. You never get the...
So it stays in the government.
Sure,
budget.
Sure. It's just never paid out to the Social Security annuitants.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll try to get one more here. Champaign. Hello. Line one.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I was wondering, given that Representative Johnson voted for the Military Commissions Act, if he could kind of give a brief summary of who determines now, in the context of that act, which people are entitled to habeas corpus now?
Well, the Congress determined it in terms of the framework of the legislation. I'm not sure I entirely understand what you're saying. I suppose it's like any other law that the legislative branch passes,
well,
the executive branch has to administer. And are you indicating, and is there a potential for abuse in the administration of that act? Absolutely there is.
I guess what I'm wondering is, who do you think is in a position to abuse that act? Because previously, I mean, habeas corpus, the idea of habeas corpus is that you can present your case before a court and a judge. And the Military Commissions Act takes away this right from a certain class of individuals.
Enemy combatants.
Right, both citizens and non-citizens. And somebody has to decide how you fall into this class.
Ultimately,
right?
Ultimately, at the end of the day, those decisions will be made by a judicial tribunal, whether it's at a military level or more particularly in the review at a federal courts level. The court has to determine what the parameters.
The federal courts weren't allowed to get into it anymore.
Ultimately, the federal courts have the ability to be involved in everything. There's always judicial review of anything that the Congress does or doesn't pass. That's the reason why we had to go back and revisit the issue. So you're indicating who has the potential to abuse the act? The executive branch of the government does, now and in the future. My hope is that we provided such stringent McCain-driven limitations and parameters that we can both reach the objective of assuring that we deal effectively with terrorists and at the same time protect individuals' rights who are accused. My hope is and my expectation is that'll be the result. Where it isn't, there's potential for that, is anything ever a closed issue? Do we ever want to put our mind at rest when we have the potential for abuse? Of course we don't. We go back and revisit the issue to make sure that it's more effectively administered, yes. And so I'm like anything else, you never have a perfect product.
Well,
do you
have a fallback plan in mind?
Do I have a fallback plan?
Yeah, I mean, if in the event, I know it's nearly unthinkable, but in the event that the executive branch decides to abuse this power.
No, that's not unthinkable.
So
yes,
what do you do then? What does Congress do in that case?
I think we need to be, I think we're presupposing abuse.
This is not a plan.
No, I understand.
In the event that I understand.
The answer is, like any other area where legislation is passed and where there's a potential for executive branch abuse of legislative authorization, then the Congress or the state legislature or the city council, whatever the level may be, always have the opportunity to be more specific and to specifically prescribe or proscribe activities that can or can't be conducted. So I'm hopeful that won't be necessary, but I certainly think we need to be wise in being ready for it.
Well, I hope that it gets at the question of the caller. We're almost out of time. I hope you forgive me for raising the issue of Congressman Foley and how the House leadership has responded.
Sorry.
But I really feel that I would like to get a comment. Florida Congressman Foley, September 29th, resigned from Congress because it was revealed he was sending sexually explicit emails to former teenage male congressional pages. Questions have been raised about how the leadership of the House has dealt with this issue and what they knew about he was doing and when. Do you think that the response of the House leadership to this matter has been what it should be?
No, I don't think it's been what it should be from day one. Was it wanton and intentional? I don't think so, but I don't know. And I think that a thorough review by the FBI, by the House Committee on Standards and otherwise, of the response of the House administration, the House leadership, to a sickening situation needs to be conducted, and we'll let the chips fall where they may. I don't want to be one of these people who presupposes guilt on the part of House leaders and call for the resignation of individuals prior to our knowing what happens or had happened. But this is an outrageous situation, and I think that individuals in leadership positions would freely admit, or they should freely admit, that the response was not what it should have been.
Some people have suggested that the congressional page program should just be eliminated.
Ray LaHood suggested that, yeah. And there's a lot to be said for at least reexamining a program where there's been a history, both Republican and Democrat leadership, of abuse. We only have to look to the 1980s to see the scandal that occurred there. And there have been periodic potential scandals and actual scandals that have emanated from the program. I sponsored a couple of pages, and they've done a superb job, and I think it's a very very good system that can be very enlightening to the individuals in it. John Pyland, our former state's attorney, was a congressional page. But I also think when we entrust 16, 17-year-olds to the care of adults, the adults have to act like responsible adults and like responsible parents, and when they don't, then we need to, A, hold them accountable, and, B, perhaps look at abolishing or at least suspending the program until we make it work better.
All right. Well, thanks very much for being
here. You're welcome. Thanks,
Tim Johnson, a Republican member of Congress serving in the House from the 15th District. He will be joining his opponent here in the election, Dr. David Gill, in a joint appearance on WYLL-TV Friday night at 8 o'clock. So you want to tune in for that.